From our headquarters in Oslo, Norway, and on behalf of our host, Robbie Peralta, welcome to the Mnemonic Security Podcast.
Nuclear power plants are considered among the most secure of the world's critical infrastructure. They're built to withstand hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, and you guessed it, cyber attacks. But think about actually defending that infrastructure. The stakes are relatively high, considering, you know, a nuclear meltdown. And the adversaries you're protecting against, well, they're probably amongst the most advanced and persistent in the world. And just to add to that pressure just a tiny bit, consider having dozens of agencies and regulatory bodies checking over everything you are doing and suggesting. And like all things security, if things go smoothly and according to plan, nothing will happen. But if you get it wrong, well, you've seen Chernobyl, right? Thankfully, there actually exists a group of people that answered yes to this challenge, and today I have the honor of speaking with two of them. Nicholas Burnett and Guido Velacis, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a great pleasure having you here, and it's not every day that I have people working with nuclear power on the podcast. So why don't we start out with an introduction to who you are and what you work with?
Sure. Well, Robbie, thanks for having us both on here. It's a great opportunity for us to join the podcast forum and have an engaging conversation with yourself, with Guido, my colleague. So thanks for the opportunity. Thanks for the introduction. My name is Nick Burnett. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for EDF Energy and Nuclear Build. So we are the business unit for EDF Energy in the UK that is delivering the new EPR reactor down in Hinkley Point in Somerset, where we're going to build two. And so my remit covers everything that is cybersecurity and information assurance related, which also includes operational technology and the cybersecurity of that, which neatly leads into Guido's role.
Yes. Good morning, Robbie. Yes, as Nick was saying, thank you very much for inviting us. I'm Guido Villasis. My role is INC, cybersecurity. I'm particularly interested in ensuring that the systems that we put in the plant that are there to protect the plant, to help operations, that they are implemented with adequate security.
Great, great. Well, awesome. I've been looking forward to this. So tell us a little bit about EDF Energy.
EDF Energy is Europe's largest nuclear provider. Our parent company is French, as by the name is Energie de France. And they are the only owner-operator of the nuclear power generation in the UK. And through that, through their development, we are delivering the EPR, which is the European Pressurized Reactor Design, which has been built in a number of other places around the world, namely in France, China, and Finland. And we're now building it here in the UK, in Somerset, to obviously maintain that energy production that we need for electricity demand in the UK, as our older fleet, you know, will at some point in the relative near future come to the end of its natural, you know, safe life to generate.
Yeah, maybe the only thing to add is that obviously EDF is not only nuclear, so the portfolio is wider. So we also have renewables generation, so wind farms. We also have conventional power, gas stations, and we still have a couple of coal-fired power stations that are going to be closed very soon, or are in the process of being decommissioned. And on top of that, obviously, we have the customer business, effectively. So we are also, we have a business that deals with delivery of electricity to the final customers.
Yeah, we get, you know, I mean, the world's getting greener. We've got to get greener, and we want to be part of that mission to deliver that for the UK. And
yes,
yeah, that's our focus.
And recently, I think there have been, you know, a new very challenging objectives for CO2 emissions reductions have been announced. So we're definitely taking part in that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for doing that. We support it. We love it. But dumb question, and I'm assuming you guys get this question all the time. What is a nuclear power plant these days? I think of Chernobyl. I'm sure you guys have seen it and have had to. Every single time you explain this, you have to relate it to that, I'm sure. But, why don't you give us an introduction to, like, what is a nuclear power plant these days?
I think it's amazing. You know, first of all, it's amazing. That's why I have joined the industry 10 years ago. It was always sort of my objective at some point to work in the nuclear industry. And I think from the point of view, if we compare with the fossil power plant at the higher level, the principles are quite similar in terms of the cycle that you need to produce energy. So it's always start with a heat source that that is used to heat the water to produce the steam, which is in turn used to move a turbo generator that generates our electricity. So obviously the main difference is in the heat source, and so as opposed to a fossil power plant where we need to burn coal or gas or any other fuel. In the nuclear plant, we use uranium, and the process to produce heat is the fission of that material. Effectively, it releases a huge amount of energy.
And so I won't go into the uranium diffusion part, but it's literally just producing heat and producing steam, which turns some turbines and generates energy. It's almost that simple besides the uranium part. What does that mean from an IT perspective? Like, where does IT fit in there in that sort of process?
Guido's closer to the technology than I am, I have to admit. But, you know, if you look at our older power stations, we're still running power stations that are 40, 50 years old or even 60 years old in design. They're all analog. The transition, you know, through the last 3-4 decades has been obviously going more, increasing the connectivity. And if you look at our current design, that is more connected, you know, or digitally enhanced than ever before. So we have very, you know, separate networks, you know, air gapping systems, as you would expect. But at the same time, you know, the way we approach it is we want it connected, but we also want it disconnected from the wider world for, you know, security reasons, to be able to manage and operate the system and have that confidence and assurance in it. So, you know, we have a big role. Guido carries a lot of the weight here. You know, there's a big project ahead with him and colleagues around the security of the cyber systems, so cyber security around our operational technology on the plant, around the systems that will run the plant, that will run the safety systems, the backup systems, etc. So there's a huge amount of IT involved, I think. You know, I dread to think of the thousands of kilometers of cabling of connectivity on a nuclear power plant, but there is that at the very least.
And you guys mentioned earlier that the this sort of scope or the spec for this plant, it's the same in other places in the world.
So I think it's fair to say, Guido may well add more to this, that the principle of the design is the same, but we have, as you would expect with certain things, had the opportunity and the time to evolve the design where we wanted to in some places. And then obviously we operate in a highly regulated environment. So the regulator has a potential influence on some areas where they deem that we want to raise the bar beyond, you know, what is accepted as a really good baseline. So that whole process has already sort of taken part years before. And then Guido will add to this, you know, where there's an opportunity to deliver something that might be more current on a system, on a network, and we can do that with any negative implications on the wider design, because it's a very fine balance between a design that came to fruition many years ago that has evolved for all the right reasons to a point where you must almost draw a line in the sand in order to deliver it. As you'll appreciate, you can't keep on evolving the design when you're delivering such a significant piece of infrastructure that takes years, you know, of time to design, to plan, to build, to then commission, let alone then get into operations. So there comes a point where you draw that line, you accept that design, unless there's a significant reason that's identified.
So I have a million questions. My mind is going all over the place. We're going to be all over the place today, but I will start with a very fundamental, simple question that I like to ask my customers, and that is, what's the worst that can happen? Where do you start your work in security with a nuclear power plant?
I want to go back effectively to what I just said before. So safety, that's a starting point for us. And as I mentioned before, and that also influence the way that we implement the OT systems in the plant, and ultimately influences the way we secure the systems. So that's our starting point. In terms of security, we always go back to what could happen in terms of safety, and what we are concerned is effectively an uncontrolled release of radioactivity, effectively. So security underpins safety. Mm. So if systems are not secure, we can't really claim that those systems are safe. So
how many people do you have looking over your shoulder when you're doing your work? I mean, I assume, like you mentioned regulation. How does that process work? You don't just get to make a decision and push it into production. I'm assuming it's not like that.
Anything that is of particular significance or hits a certain level from a governance perspective, we will always have to put through in front of the regulator. But first and foremost, we will have done that internally within our business. So we have for example, we have an independent nuclear assurance team that are involved. So there's always a level of, a gap between what we're doing or what maybe architects are doing to us to review, for then our internal assurance element to review before we, to then get sign off through due governance, through a security committee, et cetera, before it goes anywhere near the regulator. So we will have gone through a number of steps that I think anyone would expect us to do to first and foremost prove to ourselves that it's safe and it's secure, that the impacts are appropriate before we take it to the regulator. And that way, we like to think we get it to the regulator in a confident position. We've taken into account any relevant good practice out there in the world, lessons learned, what needs to be applied. And then we present that to the regulator, explaining our own judgment, our own case, and the benefits of it. And that works really well. The policy with our security regulator changed a few years ago. We went from a very, very prescriptive environment where you're almost told what to do, which many would think is great. That's the way to go, to an environment where we have a policy now that's very clear, but it gives us the flexibility to deliver things accordingly, and therefore enables us to take the judgment and the assurance and evidence it to the regulator to assure them, give them peace of mind. And there'll be times where they might challenge us and say, well, actually, we don't necessarily agree with that view, and this is why. And we have a good working relationship with them. But we can't choose to do anything at a whim and just implement it. We have to go through our due internal process and then out to the external process with the regulator.
Mm. To any of the listeners that are listening to this and find themselves complaining sometimes that they want to do something but they can't do it because things take too long, they should put themselves in your position and appreciate their situation.
Yeah, well, I think we all suffer from that, if we're honest. I'm looking at Guido and he's smiling as well. But if you take a step back and have that Hamlet moment, as I refer to it, yes, it's frustrating you can't put something through quickly as you want. But at the same time, it always comes back to our baseline. That safety is our overriding priority. And we put it through that due diligence to make sure that actually what we're proposing is both safe and secure and doesn't have a negative impact, on the project or, whether it's a process of construction or into commissioning or even operations, probably even more importantly down the line in operations, as we've seen with our existing fleet where we've made changes. We need to make sure that those changes don't have a negative impact on the plant, on the workforce, on our ability to generate safely and securely.
Mm. Well, the whole world appreciates the importance of safety.
When we go back to our rule that doing it right the first time, and the reason behind that is effectively that any issue today that may be unseen or in the design or in the construction, effectively it will be we say that this will be an issue tomorrow. So effectively we miss something today, it will bite us in the future once the plant is in operation, and that actually can be more costly than doing it right today. So that's why we spend the time on our process and on our construction and our design.
So I've heard safety mentioned a lot of times. Makes me think of threat modeling. Like who's out there to mess with these sort of systems? I'm assuming that I'm hoping that you two and some other people have thought about this. What who are the threat? Who's a threat to your business?
So we work. To something that we call a design basis threat that's presented by the UK government. And there's a classified document, so we naturally can't disclose that threat. But as you'd expect, that threat covers cyber, covers physical, and within that, all remits of technology that can be used. And it looks at the worst case scenario in terms of capability. And that's always developing, especially in the cyberspace. So that effectively becomes our baseline that we work to in terms of the minimum standard of security that we must deliver from a cyber IT perspective, from a physical perspective, from a personnel and resourcing perspective. we work to that baseline. So I guess the other thing to add, and Guido might want to add to this, is that so we don't use that as a static threat picture. We're always, you know, we've got very good links with UK government agencies. So with the National Cybersecurity Centre, the Centre for Protection for National Infrastructure, who will inform us of anything that's developing out there. So to take into account of anything that we might want to look at to make sure that, you know, from an IT perspective, we're up to date on patching vulnerabilities on our corporate network, or any risks that might be presented that have been highlighted through breaches in other industries or other parts of the world. So I like to think we're quite well connected with, you know, the currency of the threat. So we have that design basis threat as our baseline, but then we're always trying to keep up to date with the relevance of what's ongoing in the big bad world, and making sure that what we have in place can mitigate against those risks, or do we need to develop what we've got to ensure that, you know, we can't be impacted by that. And then that, you know, Guido will be able to say more here, but that is inherent in our design, where we air gap certain systems so they're not connected to the World Wide Web. They're more localized. We have greater control, greater assurance over it. And then that's where we look at other controls that are both physical and personnel. So we, you know, security for us in the industry is holistic. Guido and I are responsible to look at the cyber threat, but integral to that is also physical and also personnel. So how do we let people into that environment to operate? What restrictions do we put on them in terms of admin rights or role profile rights that means that person can get into that server system and administer it? Do they do it on their own, or is it a two-person rule? So there's a lot more behind the scenes that supports our cybersecurity sort of posture and approach.
Yeah, so for me, it's really a risk-based approach. Robbie, yeah. So we start always with the risk, and that goes back obviously to the threat and environment, and as we already mentioned, obviously our systems in the plant are heavily based now or relying on IT technology. So effectively, whatever is out there that is impacting IT technology, we also need to be mindful of that. As Nick was saying, obviously we keep on top with governmental agencies, but also with the industry, in terms of the latest threats, the latest attacks that are, for example, going on in similar systems around the world. We engage with the suppliers also, who keep us informed in terms of the vulnerabilities. So we use that as an input to effectively define appropriate security measures that we then use to design our INC systems, hopefully with what we call the principle of secure by design. So the idea is that effectively we keep feeding that information as we finalize the design of our systems to ensure as much as possible to the current threats, at least, that those systems are resilient. That's how we go.
The difference between OT and IT. Is that a really separated team at your organization, or is it I know, like, a lot of the, you know, Norwegian energy companies I work with, the OT guys will have a foot, you know, they're on both sides. Is that also the same in your organization, or is it actually like a little bigger difference?
Yeah, I was going to say that actually the boundary probably is getting more and more unclear. I think we have tried to define what it is OT and what is IT systems, and then on top of that we have what we call also the security systems, which is kind of difficult to say, are they OT systems or are they IT systems, or they are something different.
It's a tricky one, because they're integral to each other, really, aren't they? You know, the OT systems won't run in many cases without IT connectivity, whether that's localized, air gapped, connected to the World Wide Web. And I mean, certainly as a business, we try and run with a team. So we've got Guido and a couple other colleagues that are OT focused, but they've obviously sort of got one leg over the fence, which is IT focused as well, because of the systems requirements and the considerations. But then we have a sort of larger enterprise team that is purely related to IT and cybersecurity around IT and our corporate network and everything. So, and obviously we're reliant upon that to deliver the project and to maintain momentum and day-to-day working. But when you look at the plant, I think what we've tried to achieve, and I don't know if we're achieving it or not, Guido, is very much the focus of, so we've got Guido and his colleagues who are very much OT cybersecurity focused, on INC. So that's why the background is instrumentation and control. And when we need to, we pull in to our IT colleagues and say, look, you know, how are we going to connect the system into the SOC or the group SOC? Where's the connectivity on that? How are we going to manage that? What are the vulnerabilities and risks, you know, from an IT perspective, but then most importantly, you know, from Guido's perspective on that connectivity, if we need it, into the OT system. So there are shades of gray. I think we'd want to try and make it a bit more black and white, but I think inevitably there's a bit of no man's land, shall we say, between the two.
Hmm. And I would assume you, Guido, you have maybe some friends that aren't necessarily in the security team, maybe some engineers.
So from a background perspective, I am an INC engineer. So effectively, I work within the what we call the INC branch in my company. So those are effectively the engineers that are responsible for deploying the INC systems into the plant. So the two things got together.
Mm. Do you have any advice, since you're one of these engineers, right? Do you have any advice to you're also a security guy. Do you have any advice as an engineer to security guys, like how to properly communicate or how to, any like general advice that, because this is going to be on our OT miniseries, so there's going to be some people that are listening to it that may struggle to actually communicate sometimes to these engineers, because they, you know, if you're coming from a security standpoint, maybe there's a difference in priorities, or, you know, what's important for one side is not important for the other. Do you have any general advice to the security side of things that you've seen in your life?
I think communication, probably, Robbie, that's the main thing. You probably mentioned already is communication. Try to understand the product priorities, the impact. Don't go just ask them to implement something without listening from them. What would be the impact of what I'm asking them to do? And try to learn from them, effectively, in terms of the engineering aspects of the systems that we want to secure. I think that would be my advice.
And I'd add to that, if I may, Guido, because, you know, you're an engineer through and through. You're a thoroughbred. I don't have an engineering background, Robbie. I've been in the industry 11 years. Prior to that, you know, was in the finance sector for a while, and before that was in the military. So I come with a very different background. But what I've learned to appreciate is, and as you allude to, there's often a different language. You know, an engineer's perspective and understanding, very technical, very detailed, to a non-engineer. And so it's about getting that mutual understanding and almost layman's terms. So Guido has been very patient with me in the past of breaking it down. It's like a jigsaw, just building that picture back up. So you've got the understanding of what it means and that education going forward. And ultimately, it is about communication. It's about engaging. It's about having the patience to engage, the appreciation of understanding what we're trying to achieve, what we're mutually trying to achieve. So it's not one team versus the other. It's about identifying the journey and the mission and what you want to deliver, and then just assuring yourselves that everyone understands it and everyone understands what you're doing at each stage. So we're pretty clear as a business on that, and to make sure that at, you know, no point there's no doubt or someone doesn't understand. You know, there's no such thing as a stupid question, and there certainly isn't. But I think we're very good at that as a business.
Yeah, I think just to illustrate one example, which is a very common thing. The first thing that sometimes security experts effectively will go and ask people to do: okay, you need to patch your system. You need to make sure that your system is patched, is up to date. So go and patch your INC systems. And clearly, if you say that to an engineer, he will immediately back off a bit, because he would say, I don't want to change my system. My system is working as it is. So patching a system is effectively modifying a system, which that means effectively the whole functionality will need to be retested, revalidated. As Nick was saying, we work in the nuclear industry with a very formal process. So that process will take quite a long time to do. So patching a system in the nuclear plant, an OT system, is not the same as patching our laptop at home.
Yeah.
So that's a sort of language that needs to be understood, I think, from the security perspective.
Just a fun question from my side, and I know you don't have to answer it if you shouldn't. But how long does it take to actually patch a system in your world?
It depends. It depends, Robbie, of the system itself, the significance. We in our plants classified our systems based on their significance to safety. So the more significant the system is, the more time it will take to do any change, I would say. So So it could take a year, for example, to implement a modification in a system, because we would need to go through the full process of requirements, design, implementation, testing, verification, etc., for any modification.
And also, as a follow-up question to that, if you're allowed to say, how do you even go about, virtual patching sort of things like that? Like, what do you do about that then?
Yeah, we work with our suppliers, first of all, to understand, as I said before, vulnerabilities. So if the suppliers come back to us and say, okay, this system is has this vulnerability, we recommend you to apply this patch. We will, first of all, analyze if that patch actually applies to our system. And then obviously we will need to go through, if we believe that obviously there is a big risk, or there is a risk in, if we don't do that, what we will do is we will go through the process of modification, which is a very formal process that we need to follow effectively. So then we will use our test systems, our test beds. So we will never implement that patch, that modification straight away into an operating system. We will be using, first of all, test beds to validate that patch before we go into the live system.
That's at least means that you have a close cooperation with your vendors, which I'm sure a lot of people listening to this podcast would appreciate if they had a better cooperation with them. But in your terms, I mean, these contracts with your vendors and your partners, right? They're long-term, really long-term partnerships. So, I don't know if it was you or if it was my colleagues that made me think about this, but like designing these systems and putting a system, how long is this power plant going to be in operation the next foreseeable future, right? So how do you go about like partnering with companies when you have such a long-term goal and vision, mission?
Well, there's some very well-established partners, and EDF Energy Group actually has inherently a lot of capability. But if you look at the likes of your Siemens, et cetera, that are, you know, genuine international businesses that have operated in the environment for decades, you know, and like any business, you know, you go into a partnership with them for the long term and hope they'll still be there at the other end. But then you also look at understanding your own capability to support those systems first and foremost. But yeah, you're right. We have several long-term partnerships. You know, on the existing fleet, we will have the same for the EPR that we're building in Somerset. And again, it comes back to, you know, like every business, it's about the relationships you establish with your supply chain and your partners to maintain and deliver it. So they're an element where we're here constructing significant partnerships. We'll then move into, you know, our commissioning phase, where we start fitting out the plant and the systems and working more closely with those suppliers beyond just the manufacture and assurance and delivery. And with many of them, we'll be working with them for the life of the plant,
which is at the moment 60 years from the time it goes live. And obviously life has shown actually that after that time, people start thinking about maybe extensions. So over the whole period, we will implement what we call a lifetime management program, where we will work with our suppliers, with each of them, to ensure as we go that we are able to maintain those systems operating safely. It may well be that at some point, we need to team with them for some of those systems to think about upgrading them and replacing them, with the idea that, we keep the plant operating. That's how we work.
Yeah, and we have, and within the sort of cybersecurity fold, the teams that Guido and I work in, we actually have specific supply chain security assurance teams. So they will go out to our priority suppliers, support them in terms of their delivery, the systems, you know, how they're operating, how they manage our information and data. And that will continue. So with those suppliers that we, you know, continue having operational support from, we will maintain that supply chain security assurance and link through those teams respectively as well. So we're there to support them and assure ourselves throughout the time that we're working with them.
Have you talked to your supply chain friends the past couple weeks about everything going on in the world? Are they stressed? they just got a bigger budget, I'm assuming.
Solar Winds is ongoing, and we're very aware of that. We're in touch with that. In fact, I've got a call on that later today with our regulator. So our regulator is interested to know our understanding and appreciation, and but also give us updates from a government perspective as well. So we've been looking at that and you know, at appreciating the risk that that potentially presents to us. But we're quite fortunate that certainly when you look at an OT level, SolarWinds doesn't go anywhere near any of our existing fleet. It's more an IT corporate network impact. And again, luckily, you know, we haven't been impacted by it.
But I think this, you know, obviously this topic shows the importance of the supply chain assurance, as I was saying. And we spent quite substantial time, I think, in terms of working with our suppliers and performing that assurance with them. And we have specific security requirements that we share with them that we want them to help us achieving. So we spend quite a lot of time with the suppliers in order to avoid, or at least try to avoid this kind of incidents effectively happening in our systems.
Well, never a dull moment in cybersecurity. That is that's at least positive for us. We're not bored, and I'm sure all of us have a meeting about SolarWinds today at some point today and tomorrow and probably next week as well.
There's certainly never a dull moment.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time and for your efforts to making our world a greener place. I appreciate it. Everybody that I know appreciates it. So, and thank you very much for sharing your experience and your security knowledge with us.
Great. Well, Robbie, thank you very much indeed for the opportunity. Thoroughly enjoyed it. And
likewise.
I wish you a Merry Christmas.
And the same from me. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
See you next year, gentlemen. Talk to you next year.
Thank you.
Yeah, all definitely. Right. Thanks, Robbie.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for today, folks. Thank you for tuning in to the Mnemonic Security Podcast. If you have any concepts or ideas that you'd like us to discuss on future episodes, please feel free to hit me up on LinkedIn or to send us a mail to podcast@mnemonic.no. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.